Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back. Today I am joined by a brand new guest, Vita Ayala. Vita, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I'm super stoked about this.
Yeah, we had talked for my other podcast, Welcome to Geekdom, and I found out that you were a Stephen King fan, and I was like, oh yes, need to ask them to be on this podcast as well. And today we are talking all about the 2006 novel, Cell. It sure is something.
It sure is. Yeah. It felt a little bit like man yells at cloud if cloud is technology.
But, yes.
You know, we'll get into that, I'm sure.
Yeah. And this was actually one of the first Stephen King books I had read because my mom had been collecting the books in the mass market paperbacks as they were coming out. But she stopped, I want to say, around 98 or 99, I believe. Wizard in Glass was the last one she bought before she stopped buying them. And this one was a gift that was given to me. So it was like the only hardcover we had at the time. And that's how I know she didn't buy it, because I was like, yeah, she wasn't a fan of hardcover. Still isn't, you know, I like paperbacks too. But it was one of the first King books I read because someone had gifted it to me. And I was a child when this came out.
What a strange gift. Why would you give any child a Stephen King book? I say, having been reading Stephen King books since I can remember reading. So,
you know,
fair enough.
Maybe my friend's mom was just able to predict the future.
Maybe. That'd be incredible. I've seen that you're going to get a lot of mileage out of this book.
Yeah, exactly. And
I'm like the opposite of you. I love hardcovers. And so one of the projects that I have for myself is if I see a cheap Stephen King hardcover, I'll buy it. Like, I just have to buy it. So I've been like replacing my mass media paperbacks slowly with cheap hardcovers.
Oh, don't worry. I have bought many a hardcover since then, because I would go to like library bookstores or just was this place that would do like a big blowout sale, and they would have books for like 50 cents. And I was like, well, I cannot say no to this. So I have the ginormous hardcover of Under the Dome. I am unsure how I'm going to hold it to read it. But
you know, I know a website where you can get a dictionary stand. You could just pop right out there.
Just going to do that, get a music stand or something, you know? That might be the best way to go for that book. But thankfully, Cell, not nearly as long as something like Under the Dome. And I had no recollection of this book, I have to admit. I returned to it and I was like, I remember something bad with cell phones. And that's about it.
I remembered like weird details, but almost all the plot like in character stuff was gone until I reread it. I was like, there was a shoe. I remember the shoe. And
that explains the shoe on the cover. That's for sure.
Yeah. I totally forgot about that. Yeah. The cover on the wiki is not the cover that I remember.
Oh, that one is the cover that I have, but the shoe is on the spine.
Oh, see, I think I remember the spine. That's what it is. Because I remember the shoe from the cover, too.
Yeah.
We should probably not talk about the cover further. I'm sorry. I could talk about, like, every aspect forever. So you have to keep me on track. I apologize.
It's okay. And to jump right in, I want to quickly run through the characters, because clearly neither you nor I really remembered who these characters were until we started reading it again. And then I was like, oh, okay. This is kind of sounding a little familiar. You have your main few characters who we spend a lot of time with in Clayton Riddell, Tom McCourt, and Alice Maxwell. I always forget that Alice is so young, because when you're reading the story, you're like, wait, this is a teenager.
Yeah, but he certainly does not speak of her as a teenager, which is kind of a thing he does a lot. But like,
yes,
I kept forgetting because I was like, please stop making the main character have weird semi-sexual thoughts about this child.
Yeah, I was like, is this happening or am I reading a different book than I remember?
Yeah, I was like, is she a teenager or is she look young? Like, is it one of those things where it's like, she's 30, but she could be 18. No, she's like 16, like 15, 16.
Yeah, she's 15. And then you have Jordan, who is 12. None of these children seem to be their age.
So I always like read Stephen King stuff and look for the Stephen King insert. And I feel like at first I thought it was Clay, but it might have been Jordan. I'm not sure, but it felt like, I was like, there's a reason that this kid gets all the moments that he gets. I think this one's you.
Yeah. And you have his headmaster, Charles. There are quite a few characters who don't really have last names because we see them in passing and they're not a huge, huge part of the story. But you have Dan, Denise. And do you know about the eBay auction that let someone be written into the book?
No, that's incredible.
Okay, so I was reading this on the wiki page when I was prepping for this, and basically they had an auction where you could get your name as a character in this book, and the character is Ray Huizenga. I'm probably butchering that last name, but basically this woman won the auction and decided to gift it to her friend Ray, and he's one of the zombies in the story. And I thought that was just very interesting, because then I guess a bunch of other authors started doing this too, and it cost this woman $25,000 to get her friend in this book.
He's the hero, right? Like the guy that like helps them blow it up, but like, We'll get there. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm jumping ahead. Construction worker. Right?
Oh, that's awesome. That's too expensive for that, but that's also really cute.
I mean, look, if you're rich and you have the money, go for it. Do your thing.
The opposite with comic book writers, we just put people in stuff. that's the secret. We'll secretly sneak people into like books.
Yeah.
For free.
You're like, maybe I should rethink my strategy here.
Yeah, man. Yeah. Now I need to figure it out. Maybe I'll make people donate to charity to be in my next book.
Yeah, I thought that was just a really fun tidbit about this book. I try to find those things, and sometimes it's easier with the movies because you have little Easter eggs to other stuff or people who appear in multiple Stephen King adaptations, or you have someone like Mick Garris who does 800 of them.
Right. You have to have a through line.
Yeah. And, you know, what's fun about Clayton's character is that he's a graphic artist, and he is basically in town because he made this deal in, you know, the town being Boston. So this doesn't necessarily take place in Maine at the start, which I think is always interesting for Stephen King, because we see him in Maine a lot. And then, you know, Colorado's kind of a secondary location. I know some stuff has happened in Florida, which makes sense because yes. He has, I guess his winter home is in Florida, so he doesn't have to live through the Maine winters anymore.
Listen, if you had that kind of money, wouldn't you do that?
Maybe not in Florida, but yes.
Maybe not in Florida. Yeah, sure. Fair enough. Yeah, there's a couple of places that happen often. I feel like maybe Boston is another one that he's done a couple of times, but I'm not 100% sure. But yeah, it is really interesting that it starts there. Another tidbit, Clay, the deal that he's making for his original graphic novel is with Dark Horse.
Yeah, fun little thing there.
I was like, that's a real company. How did you do that?
Tell me your secrets, Clay.
Yeah, like, holy smokes, please help a brother out. No, it felt like, I don't know. I connected with Clay pretty early, not just because he was the main character, but just like he was just hustling so hard, like, and trying so hard to hold on to his art, even when the world like collapses. I was like, I feel you, man. I feel you. That's a lot of years of work.
Yeah, he's holding on to his art, and he's also trying to hold on to hope that his family, his son in particular, Johnny, is still alive. And he's separated from his wife, Sharon, you know, they're kind of estranged, but he's so adamant to get back to Johnny that and his art sort of drive him for this entire story.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, King does a really good job of kind of setting Clay up for that to be believable. Sometimes you get like end of the world stories and you're just like, I don't, just stop. Just like, what are you doing? Go do the thing that clearly makes sense. But for Clay, like, very early on, he kind of sets up Clay as not just someone who is obsessive, and he is obsessive, and he kind of does that through the art, but also someone who just has to go on faith. Like, it's not a religious faith, but like his entire career is based, you know, he was doing speculative work that he wasn't being paid for on the hope that one day he would be paid for it. And it came in between him and his wife. Like, that was a thing in their marriage that like caused tension. Like, that's how much he can believe in something that isn't actually in front of him. So like for him, chasing down his son. Like, it made total 100% sense.
Yeah, and you have Tom and Alice who almost immediately team up with Clay because wherever they are, they all happen to be in the same lobby, essentially. And Alice is looking for her mom or something, but her mom's kind of already gone crazy. So the premise is that there was this big pulse that went off and anyone who used their cell phone would almost immediately be homicidal.
Yeah, or suicidal, or
right.
It was like a, how do they describe it? Like an EMP, but for your brain. So it gets wiped completely of everything except for the source. And apparently the source is absolutely being bazonkers, just violent.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting thesis for a book. Humanity at its core is violent and bad. Okay.
Right. And while you were reading this, you texted me and you're like, this is his I Am Legend, isn't it? Which
100%.
I haven't read, but I've watched the movie. So I'm at least, you know, familiar with the premise. And part of me was like, yeah, it's like that, but also kind of like The Walking Dead.
It is very much like The Walking Dead. Although I think The Walking Dead owes a lot to I Am Legend. I think pretty much a lot of things like that of this genre owe a lot to I Am Legend, but it felt especially like that, not to spoil a book that's decades old, in the movie, so you kind of get it. But yeah. in the book more, whatever happens to make people vampires, you're in the perspective of a human who sees them as monstrous and sees them eat people or whatever. But what you discover is that, you know, he's been going out and killing them when he can, like one by one, and trying to figure out their weaknesses or whatever. And what you realize is that, like, they actually have a whole society, like they're completely rational beings. Like they're not just mindless monsters. And to them, he's the evil one because he's been murdering people who have not done anything to him. And so for like, as I was reading this, I was like, as soon as you get the, like, jumping ahead a tiny bit to the antagonist, which is really a hive mind of all of the people who are pulsed, but instantiated in a who they call the Raggedy Man. It's like a black dude in a hoodie. To him, they're just trying to live. And then these quote unquote normal people are going around killing them. So they're going to take revenge. And I'm like, oh, this is 100% like Stephen King, like just lifting the basic premise of I Am Legend and going, but what if I Stephen Kinged it up and also technology is evil? Technology older than the radio is bad.
And I know when the book came out, he still didn't own a cell phone, which is a little odd for someone of his stature in society in general. Usually people who have money are the ones who get these things before everyone else. And he seemed to be very against it. But given that we now know how often he's on Twitter,
yeah,
I have to feel like that might have changed by now.
He rewrites the book and it's Twitter that's evil. It's anyone who was on Twitter, which I might be sympathetic to. Fair enough. That place is like
not wholly inaccurate.
But it was really interesting too, because he has, at one point he has the headmaster character talk about how computers are okay. They're not evil, but he's always thought of cell phones as the devil's, what was it? The devil's radio or the devil's walkie talkie. I don't remember. It was something clever. I'm not as clever as Stephen King. And I was like, oh, okay. So you're justifying your use of a computer to write this, but cell phones are bad.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
The irony is wonderful in that. Not to say that my cell phone hasn't potentially ruined my brain, but,
you know, I'm a little more sympathetic now towards this idea than I was at the time. At the time, I think I was like 21. I had my little flip phone. I was like, whatever, like, it's fine. But now that I can just, like, you could just be on your phone for hours, I'm like, oh, I remember the outside. What if I couldn't use my cell phone anymore? Would that be good? I bet that would be good. So I'm sympathetic. Uncle Steve, I feel you.
Yeah. I just really thought that this was his attempt at going all out with a zombie story, but adding in a present day element to it as well. And while obviously this is a thing cell phones have not done at all, at the time, it probably seemed like something that was actually a fear for some people, not necessarily that people would become zombies, but that cell phones would kind of ruin everything. And if you ask some people, they probably have.
Well, and two, I will say, I'm playfully poking at it, but I think that the idea that something that everyone is connected to, or almost everyone is connected to, that is so prevalent, you know, just being around everywhere, being hijacked by an unknown malevolent force is really interesting, right? Because it's not the, you know, the people that end up being the like hive mind or whatever, they're the victims of a terrorist attack, or so that's what's supposed. And there's never anything you see to the contrary, right? So it's like some group of people figured out how to hijack cell phone signals and mess with people's brains. You know, that's actually really a really smart and really creepy premise, right? Because like imagine, right, that you could, I mean, you can hack into other people's cell phones. It's actually not hard at all, right? That's already scary. And yeah, that's how people get into people's like the cloud and you know, like iCloud and steal their photos or whatever. But imagine if you could weaponize that against them physically. That's terrifying. And there are so many more cell phones now than there were at the time. I think it's even scarier to read it now because it's just like, well, the first thing I would do if I saw things going crazy is probably like get on my cell phone. I probably wouldn't call anyone, so maybe I'd be spared there. But like, you know, like the right, like the first thing you do when shit goes down, seasonal language, is like, oh, I gotta check online, I gotta see what's going on, I gotta text my mom. Like,
it's like when an earthquake happens in California and everyone tweets about it.
Exactly. And what if it was the phone's screen instead of some sort of like auditory pulse that drove you nuts? Like, that's the update for now, right? Like, if that was like released now, like, that's so scary.
Yeah, it's funny because I just watched the first episode of Animaniacs, the new one, and I don't want to give anything away, but there's an appearance by Pinky and the Brain, and the Brain has this mastermind plan to use cell phones to mind control everyone. And I thought that was just really funny to watch, especially after reading this book.
Perfect timing. It's in the air.
Yeah.
You know, we have these characters who I think he does a very good job too of making us care about them. He makes them very distinct in this book, which he doesn't always do. Sometimes for me, like, I feel like he has more of a type of character, but here they felt very much like individual people. They were very different from each other, but drawn together by circumstance. Right. So you have like the gay guy who he doesn't play up. Like, the joke isn't that he's gay, which is really nice. he's just a gay dude. This is the thing that separates him from, you know, the straight dude. And so they have very different experiences, and that comes to bear later on, which is really great. And then you have the girl who just, there are two brain cells for the whole group, and she has both of them. for a 15-year-old girl, she is really, like, really sharp. Not that 15-year-old girls aren't, just she's not an adult, but she is often the adult, that kind of stuff. I think that in general, he did a pretty damn good job, like, making the characters believable and compelling. Like, I wanted to follow them on the adventure, even though, like, for long stretches of time, nothing was really happening.
Yeah, this was definitely still a very weird book and probably not one of my favorites, to say the least, but also not the worst. It was one I kind of ended up feeling a little indifferent about, and I think a lot of it has to do with what you just said. There were a lot of times where it felt like there wasn't really anything happening.
It felt like a little bit like a Stephen King does The Lord of the Rings, a little bit, but much shorter. And I do love Lord of the Rings as well. But like, there are just huge swaths of that adventure where nothing is happening. And it was kind of the same here, where you're just like, and now they're walking, and now they're walking some more, and now they find a piece of paper, and now they're walking some more. They see some sad stuff on the road. There's a bird. Now they're walking. They go to Tom's house. They see the cat. They go to Clay's house. They see a bird. You know what I mean? Like, I was just like, all right. But yeah, I mean, the action when it happens is kind of sudden and explosive and very violent. It is a very, very violent, like a weirdly violent book for a book that is generally like nothing is happening.
In some ways, it felt a little like some of the Dark Tower books, where you would have certain books where, you know, The Gunslinger, for instance, Roland is walking a lot. And it is one of the shorter Dark Tower books, obviously, but you get that kind of feeling like King really enjoys writing about people walking because you have the gunslinger, you have the long walk, which is literally a long walk. You have this, you know, there's more walking in the other Dark Tower books too, of course. But I think what he did well in the Dark Tower books that didn't necessarily come through here was he added the element of Roland telling stories while they were on this journey so that it would pass the time and not feel like they were necessarily standing in one place.
For me, this felt like it needed the same editor as The Gunslinger because it felt like it should be that long. Because The Gunslinger is pretty short too. Like, it's shorter than this by far. And there was like chunks of stuff where I was like, oh, you didn't need this at all. I just think your editor can no longer tell you no. like, it wasn't bad. It wasn't stuff that was bad, but it was just like, oh, this is, you got to trim the fat on this. You know, use that delicious fat for other things. But this needs to be a lean story because this is supposed to be us in this person's head as opposed to world building. So we don't need as many words. And he repeats a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
A lot. Like, people will say the same thing and it's not like a motif. It's just like back to back to back. And you're like, Stephen, please, please. You know, at the same time, like, you have these moments of like tension where even there isn't anything necessarily bad happening that I thought was really cool and really interesting. Like, when there's a point where the cell phone people, who I keep calling the hive mind, but they start invading their dreams, and Clay wakes up and he's drawing the person that he saw in his dream. And the act of drawing is so beautifully described and also so like intense for no reason. You're like, he's just drawing a picture, like, everyone relax. But like, it really is like you're with him and it's so intense. And the way he describes this person's face, like, I could see this person. Mm-hmm. And I was like, all right, like, that to me, that's perfect story stuff for this.
He calls them the phone crazies or the phoners.
Yeah.
Not the most clever nickname for them, but it is what we are working with. And I really think that the time we spend with Clay, Tom, and Alice gives us a very good idea of who those characters are. And it's kind of what keeps you going with this story, because I truly think this might have worked better as a novella-length story, because, you know, I read The Colorado Kid right before this, and that flew by. This, even though it is one of his shorter books, which is a funny thing to say because it's just a normal-length book, you know, it still felt like it was too long. And if I have any one sort of overall criticism of King books, is that most of them could be edited down more. And looking ahead at what I have to read, I'm just like, ooh, did they do anything?
I think at this point he was too big to really edit. And he's not like, I don't think that he's difficult to work with. Like, the way that he talks about writing in his own book, about writing in his books, about writing and stuff like that, like, it makes it seem like, no, he's perfectly fine taking notes. But I feel like once you get to a certain level of like making people money, they just stop editing you, which is a huge fear of mine. So like, yeah, this book could have been half the length. Like, if I was to, you know, I bet if he had the chance to make it the quote unquote best version of itself, he would cut it in half. He would start with them already leaving, you know, Boston, like they're already leaving or whatever, like cut out that whole first part and just have minor flashbacks to it and stuff like that. And like, you know, instead of it being the walk that was important, it'd be the stops that are important. But I'm not sorry I read it again. Like, I don't mind that I've read it twice. And usually I don't like rereading things if they don't wow me. So, you know, it was a fun activity.
Yeah. And there are definitely some books of his that I'll probably go back and revisit. Like I mentioned, I read the edited version of The Stand. So I did buy the unedited edition, basically. And one day in the far future, I will go back and visit that one. But, you know, I've had a few that I had read early on, like years and years before I decided to do this podcast. And early on, I made the mistake of not rereading The Shining because I thought I had read it recent enough to remember the details. And then
it's different.
I'm sure I edited this out, but I thought the twins were in the book because I had the movie in my head.
You edited it out. It wasn't in the episode. That's funny though. Because they're so iconic, right? To the movie that it Yeah.
And I was like, wow, I am not kicking this off very well if I can't get details straight. Thankfully, it's been a little more smoother of a ride here, but I did end up rereading The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon, another short one, you know, that's novella length. And that was one I had read early on, same with The Green Mile, because I think what happened was I saw some of these books and I was like, oh, those ones are short. I'll read those. Because I was, you know, in middle school, high school, whenever I read these, way too early. Most likely, as many Stephen King fans start out.
What does it say about us, though? Like all the people that I know that have read Stephen King way too early are of a certain type. Like, we're all into a lot of the same stuff. I'm like, what does it do to your brain to read Stephen King before you're, like, fully baked?
Wonderful things, if you ask me. I mean, I don't know.
I agree. I 100% agree.
But yeah, basically, I had gone through and read some of the shorter books, and because we have the six little chapter books for The Green Mile, I was like, oh, I'll read those. And I was like, I don't think I understood this book the first time I read it.
There were so many things that, like, I want to go back and reread of his just because I was way too young. Like, I read The Dead Zone. I was way too young for that. I don't know how old I was. Maybe, like, 12, something like that. I couldn't fully grasp. And, like, I remember when Desperation came out, I read The Regulators instead because Desperation was the bigger one, but it was like they came out at the same time, right?
And they were like, yeah, it was the same day.
Different universe. And I was like, all right, I'll do the short one. I don't remember what year that was, but I was definitely, I could not fathom what I was reading at the time. So
I'm still not sure I could tell you what happened in those books. And I just read them this year.
Yeah, I would be interested. I liked what he did there where he was like same characters, different universe. I wonder what that would look like for Cell. Like what other kind of adventure could these characters get up to? Because I can imagine them in like his other books and how they would be reacting. Like imagine them in like The Stand or something. Like it's like a similar situation, but to the left. Like I can imagine like which groups they would end up in and how they would like fight against where they were going and stuff like that. So that's a good idea.
Well, if you look at how long it took him to give us a sequel to The Shining, nothing is impossible with him.
That's fair. That's fair.
There is one thing I really want to talk about, and it is the child's shoe that Alice finds and kind of uses as a way to house her anxiety and trauma.
Yeah. Wow.
It was just very strange, but also very interesting because you're like, a shoe.
A baby Nike. I was like, oh yeah. No. He never explains it. You never see anything like that has to do with it. And he never shies away from violence. So it was very clearly purposeful. Like, there's no body. There's no anything. It's just like a baby shoe. And I was hyper fixated on that shoe as I was like reading the book. I was like, when she loses it, I was like, oh no. I knew what was going to happen to her when she lost the shoe. Like the first time too. I remember thinking that.
Yeah.
Where I was like, oh, this shoe is an instantiation of her. She's like this lost baby shoe because she lost her mom. Like her mom tried to kill her and like all this kind of stuff. Like she's without her other half. And now that the shoe's gone, she's gone. It's only a matter of time, which is the only thing that really pissed me off about the book. There's a couple of things where I was like, well, that is of a time. Oh boy.
Yeah.
But like, spoiler to later on in the book, she is the only one of the main, I'll call them the main four, because I count Jordan amongst them.
Yeah.
To die. And I was like, you had three white question mark cis male characters and you killed the only girl. Okay. And then he brings on another girl as if it's the same. I'm like, No. You don't get to do that. That was a part in the book that like I like checked out a little bit, but I made it through. Made it through to the end.
Yeah, it was certainly a rough moment when you know you're going to lose Alice, because even though she's a teenager who might not be the most helpful, you understand exactly why she's acting the way she's acting because of everything that has happened. And it's going to take her longer to process these things than it would for Clay or Tom, because they have the capacity to understand, we just need to get through this. Whereas Alice is this terrified girl who is trying to deal with this trauma and anxiety and so many other things all at once that it would probably overload most teenagers.
And I gotta say, like, once she kind of gets it together, she's solid for the rest of the time that she's in the book. Like, yeah, she's, you know, super unstable in the beginning. But like you said, like, she just, like, literally, like, her mom just tried to murder her in the streets. Like, and she was running from someone who was going to do God knows what from her. So when you first meet her, she is an absolute mess. I'm like, well, that's reasonable. And then she pulls it together. And then she's the one that gets them on the road. She's the one that's like, we have to pack these things. We have to do this. We have to do that. When the men are kind of at loose ends. And so, like I said, she's the one with the two brain cells between the lot of them. So it is a real bummer when you lose her. And I think he felt like he had to kill someone.
Uh-huh.
And I think that, like, he just did the math, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can't kill the main character, which I think is wrong. I think you can definitely kill the main character. Game of Thrones proved that. Can't kill the main character. Well, killing the gay dude would be wrong, because there's only one gay dude and that's messed up. And then the little boy reminds him of his son, so we have to keep him around to put him in danger later, so we have to kill the girl. I see your calculus there. I just don't think that's true. I think you can hurt them without killing them. I don't think you need to do it. But, you know, it made sense. And then you do meet up with that other group of characters who does have their own girl. It's another two dudes and a lady, and she's pregnant, so we have to be extra worried about her.
Yeah. Sometimes he makes choices and you're like, did you need to do that? But you have other times where you have female characters who are the central figures. And while they might not be handled perfectly, he does like to give, especially children, these powers and capabilities that are beyond their years. You see it with Carrie. You see it in Firestarter with Charlie. A bunch of the kids in It. You see it with Jake in The Dark Tower. And here you do ultimately see it with Alice and Jordan, because Jordan is definitely a bright child. You know, he knows what he's talking about. And I think a lot of that obviously has to do with the school he was going to and just him being able to kind of theorize on what's going on.
Having him be the younger person who's more dialed into technology and was really smart, and then also like setting it up so it's like, I don't have friends, so all I do is like mess around on the computer and stuff. It's like, okay, now there's a believable reason why you would have all this knowledge too.
He's the nerd.
He's a tiny nerd who just likes to hang out with the teacher after school and stuff. I'm like, that's adorable. He's super cute. He also, like, MVP, like, becomes a track star champion at the end of the book, which you're like, all right, buddy.
It's like, oh, you've been hiding this from us.
Yeah, like the whole time. I think that King did a pretty good job with Jordan of making him feel mostly like a kid.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're right. I think in a lot of cases, sometimes kids are almost too wise beyond their years, which is fine because it's a book and I think that makes it interesting. He's interested in certain kinds of stories. But with Jordan, like, he gets upset and he gets to cry. He gets to be unstable for a lot longer than Alice does. And one of the things I found really interesting too is that, like, King sort of flipped what you would expect for how a young male character would act versus a young female character, for the time anyway, where, like, Alice becomes this, like, very competent, very steady figure, even though she has doubts, like, and she has that creepy little shoe. She is able to channel all of her anxiety into her talisman and kind of get them through it and give them direction. Whereas Jordan, like, he has information, but, like, you know, he has to be taken care of and kind of coddled a lot. And, like, I really liked that, because he never writes it like it's a condo. It's never bad that, like, a boy child is, like, gets to be super upset. And, like, there's a lot of hugging. Like, they, like, hug this kid. And I'm like, wow, like, for the time to have, like, grown men, like, hug a child, like a little boy in particular, instead of telling him to, like, you know, suck it up. Like, that's actually really great. For the time. So, you know, I actually really liked a lot of the stuff, little things that he did in the book with the characters in that way.
Yeah, we have yet to mention Cashwack. I'm going to pronounce it that way. And This
Shrek, no phone.
Yeah. So this is the no phone area. And it's basically everyone's goal to make it to sort of this safe zone. It's almost like what we portrayed Boulder as in The Stand.
Yeah. Only it's a lie.
Yes.
And they do a good job of before you get there, you've already put the dots together. And then, you know what it's going to be. It's not like he's pretending that it's like a safe haven. And the idea that, like, even without phones, like, this idea starts spreading throughout the normies. That's what he calls the, like, non-phoners, right? That they all start thinking that they have to go to this place with no phone reception, which I was like, wow, an area with no phone reception that is walkable, semi-walkable from Boston. Because they get there in, like, what, 2 weeks or something like that?
Yeah, that seems to be the timeline.
Yeah, by foot. I'm like, wow. What's that like? What a world to live in.
Walking? What's that?
What is that? I miss it.
Going outside?
Huh? Oh my God. During these pandemic times, I sure do. I'm a New Yorker, so I'm a big walker as well. So I was walking vicariously through this book.
Good way to do it. That's the safe way.
Yes, exactly. Can I just like a side note tangent too?
Yes.
Like, I know it's a book, but like, the idea of all of these people just hanging out with no masks made me so stressed out. It's like a book that was written 14 years ago. And I'm like, everyone wear masks. Oh my God, please. Please.
This is what 2020 has done to our brains.
I can't watch movies anymore. Every time I'm just like, mm-mm. I see a concert like in a movie. I'm like, oh no, that's the worst.
That is dangerous.
And they have everyone using the same cell phones at Cashwalk? No way. No way. Cannot be me.
We do not share anymore, people.
Sorry, I got us off track.
No, it's okay.
But yeah, the idea that all the normal people are going to go there because it's a safe zone where maybe the phoners will leave them alone is really, really interesting. And I'm glad that he doesn't play it as if that's true. I'm glad that you know that they're marching to their doom, so to speak, or what you would think is their doom. It felt a little bit to me, speaking of like Boulder and The Stand and stuff, like Clay's journey there and also the other main characters that split off from Clay, their journey felt a lot like Nadine Cross, where she's just like, I don't want to. I'm compelled to do this. I do not want to go, please. Damn it, I'm here.
Yeah.
All right.
And that kind of brings us to Ray's part of the story because, you know, we touched briefly on how he's the character who was written in via the eBay auction. And that's a pretty cool thing because he does end up basically being one of the main heroes, even though we don't spend too much time with him. We don't meet him until we meet Dan and Denise. And he's conveniently a construction worker who specializes in explosives. And when you are trying to get rid of the Raggedy Man and all of these phoners who are trying to kill you, seems very handy.
Yeah, and very clever too.
Yes.
Which I really like. Because I'm always afraid of the way that people are going to be portrayed in books. We're just like, oh, he's just a construction worker. I'm like, nope, he's an expert in his field. And so he knows things like demolition, but also like how cell phone signals like would affect, I don't know, a bomb and how to rig that up. I'm like, that's 100% actually a thing that you probably know, but also like where to find demolition stuff and how to transport it safely and like all this kind of stuff. And I was like, all right, Ray gets taken out, but he's a G. Like he was a very important piece of the puzzle.
But he takes himself out because he knows that's the only way for the plan to work.
Yeah. Which noble fucking sacrifice.
Yeah.
Like, wow. Oh, totally forgot too. The Raggedy Man is entering people's dreams. He's entering everyone's dreams, like all the normies. And he marks all of the people that killed, after the initial pulse, like in the first day, all of the phoners start flocking together. They call them flocks.
Yeah.
And they start having this weird flock behavior. And so Clay and his group hear like the death knell of a bunch like not close by, but close enough. And they get the idea to kill a flock that they're near. And they do that with like Jordan and the headmaster and stuff. And so the Raggedy Man, the hive mind, is petty AF. They're not, they take long revenge, and it's their mistake to do so, but they decide that they're going to mark people like Clay as untouchables. So like no normies are allowed to touch them, but also none of the hive mind will touch them. They're like, they're shunned, and he's funneling them to kill them, you know, in a public spectacle to basically to take a long form revenge because he thinks he has the time. So like the people that they meet on the road after they kill the flock, any normies avoid them and like curse at them and like threaten them and all that stuff. They're like, no, we've seen it. You're in our dreams. Like you're the bad people. You're that bunch of people. Like you're screwed, all this kind of stuff. Which comes into play because the only people that end up talking to them are this other group, Dan, Denise, and Ray, who you end up finding out are the ones that killed the people that they heard die before. And so that's why they end up linking together, because they share in this mass murder that they've done, which is fascinating. He gets into it at the end of the book for like two sentences, but it's interesting because like, aside from the first pulse, like the phoners basically like, they're like, our time is daytime, your time is nighttime. We won't mess with you. You don't mess with us. And people are still like, there are groups of people killing them. Is this murder? So it's an interesting thing that he does, I think, and he does pretty well.
Yeah. Is there anything you want to touch on before we dive into the Clay Johnny kind of ending here?
I guess the one thing I will say is that I wish the phoner stuff, that we had more perspective on them. I know sometimes like we just following the normal people, which makes sense, but you know, in a lot of his books, he will give you a chapter or something from the perspective of the antagonist. And I wish that we had actually gotten that in this, because I would have been interested to see how the prose would have looked if we're in the perspective of this hive mind. I don't necessarily need to know their plans, but I would have loved to have known a little bit more about what they felt like. So that's the only thing I kind of wanted to talk about as well.
Yeah, when I was going through this, you know, I was like, I don't really remember a whole lot of this after sitting on it for like a week or so. And I think part of it was that, you know, you have the Raggedy Man as this big, intimidating villain. And at the same time, it almost feels like it would have worked better if he got like the Randall Flagg treatment.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. That's what I wanted. You hit, yes, exactly. I wanted him to feel like a presence. Like I wanted to feel the evil of his presence from his own perspective. That would have just been so fascinating to me.
Yeah, for sure.
I also love that he's the president of Harvard.
I love it. I love that's what they, yeah, the Ray and his bunch.
It's like, Uncle Steve, tell us how you really feel about Harvard.
Yeah, for real. He keeps mentioning that Harvard hoodie. Oh boy. What did Harvard and Boston do to you that you destroy them so completely?
As much as he loves the Red Sox, I don't know what Boston could have done to him.
Maybe he was really mad about the team that year.
Maybe. Maybe. But to wrap things up with the Clay and Johnny ending, did you get the feeling that Johnny was not Johnny at all? And Clay was kind of just, oh, here's a boy. He's mine.
Absolutely.
Okay.
The way he describes Johnny when he's actually finally describing him, like more than halfway through the book, which is bananas, he's like short and stocky and he has really short, like dark hair. And then you see this kid and it has been 10 days, 12 days since he has seen his son. And he finds this skinny, long haired kid. And I was like, that is not the same boy, sir. Like, absolutely not. He just took a boy
and started calling him Johnny, and the boy was obviously terrified of him, would not talk to him, and you're just like,
and kept trying to get away.
Wow. I understand why this happened, but we had no indication throughout the rest of the story that Clay would be this delusional.
Yeah, I think that's right. I wish we had seen his mental breaks a little bit more. I think he starts to, you start to get the feeling when he gets the letter from Johnny. This is probably the most fucked up thing that I'll say on this podcast, not ever. But I almost wish we had seen a boy in the fire or whatever, or dead, that definitely was Johnny, like, but him going, oh, that boy looks just like my son, but it's not. And then he finds this other boy and he's like, this is my son, because he's like awake, you know, and he's alive. And there's hope there. I almost wish that that was the case, because I feel like we needed one more beat of him clearly being kind of delusional before we get to that ending.
I'm glad I wasn't just making that up in my head, because I was like, did I just misread this entire section?
No, I super felt like it wasn't like Johnny at all. Like, it did not feel like his son at all. From the description also to the way that, like, the kid was reacting to him, even though he was a phoner, like, they are starting to return back to themselves a little. And this kid is, like, trying to hide from him, like, hiding under objects, wandering away. Like, yeah, that definitely wasn't his son.
Okay. I was like, I don't know if I've just read too many Stephen King books lately or what, but this seems very off.
You know what, Stephen King? You let us know either way, because clearly you must listen to this. So
yes,
hit us up.
Well, Vita, is there anything else? I think this was just one of those books. It's like you can pull a lot out of it, but it doesn't necessarily mean that I found it the most enjoyable, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think for me, ultimately, what made it not as enjoyable was it felt like his thesis was that humanity is bad, that there are only certain individuals that are good. None of them seem to be black, but that humanity at its core is bad. We get a lot of instances for this. Alice is killed because of kindness, basically, that she had towards people who end up coming back and like murdering her, like all this kind of stuff. And I just don't like books with that kind of underlying foundational premise. I think the stuff that happens with it is cool. Like there's a lot, we could talk for another hour about a lot like stuff that happens. That's kind of cool. But that for me was kind of a bummer, but I would be interested, and I might do it anyway, of seeing the movie and seeing how they adapted it to see maybe if they take a little bit of that out and give us a little bit more of like, you know, the little glimpses of hope that we get through the thing. We'll see.
I mean, I'll never be upset watching a Samuel L. Jackson movie, but I don't think I've heard many good things about Cell.
I didn't even know they made it into a movie until I looked it up like for this. Who's the main dude? It's not John Cusack, right? Like, who is it?
It is.
It is. So it's the team back together again after 1408.
Yeah. So the two of them do 1408 and they do Cell. That's together.
Really funny. Maybe I'll do a back-to-back double feature.
Double feature.
Yeah, that's all I got. Uncle Steve, I know that you were feeling down at the time and cell phones were scary. But, you know, human beings are... I think we've proven that human beings are not intrinsically evil.
Yeah, yeah. I think...
I hope.
I initially gave this a 3 out of 5. And then after sitting on it for a week and I was like, I don't remember half of what happened in this book now. I was like, it's probably more like a 2, 2.5, but Goodreads doesn't let you do half stars. So I bumped it down to a 2. It's again, not the worst thing I've read. I have read, I think 2 or 3 of his books that I just didn't really care for. And this is more of a neutral feeling. It's like, I'm not upset that I read it, but it's not The Shining or The Dead Zone.
Right. That's exactly how I felt. Like there are a few books of his that I've read where I'm like, I actively dislike this. It's nothing personal, but like there's a lot in here that is just not for me. But this one was just kind of like, this, you know, 100 pages lighter.
Yeah.
Could have been really cool.
Yeah, exactly. And going light on stories is not always his strong suit. But I did think this ending was more interesting than some of his other endings, because his endings are always a big topic of discussion, because sometimes he'll throw an epilogue in and you're like, why did you do that?
I feel like the ending definitely felt like an epilogue. I don't remember if it was anymore. See that I literally just finished this and it's already finished. But this is actually for me, like not a bad ending. I think if he had shorted up a little bit by showing his Clay's kind of mental like deterioration a little bit more, it would have made a little more sense. Like it would have hit harder, but I was like, oh yeah, this seems right.
Yeah.
For this, like there's nothing, you just hold up for the winter. That's it. That's all we got.
Yep. Well, Vita, thank you so much for joining me to talk about Cell. You will definitely be back on, so I look forward to that.
Yeah, I look forward to coming back and talking about Nightmares and Dreamscapes. Was it a TV series?
It was one season of a TV show, I believe.
Good stuff. I remember two of the stories, two of the shorts, so I have to rewatch the whole thing, but it's going to be dope. Thank you for having me. This was really fun.
Yeah, of course. All right, that does it for this episode of Chat Cemetery. You can support the podcast on Patreon for $1 a month. You'll get a thank you on the show. For $2 a month, I will send you a Chat Cemetery sticker. And if you want to follow us on social media, you can do so at Chat Cemetery on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You could also rate and review the show. That's a huge help. And as always, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.